ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, after talks in Washington, Donald Trump now aiming to set up a meeting between Volodymyr Zelensky and Vladimir Putin. Also, South Australia's Royal Commission into Domestic Violence makes more than 130 recommendations. And a record for an Australian man still going strong 4 decades after his quadruple heart bypass.
It's quite possible that his record may never be broken, but he's to be roundly congratulated on, you know, an amazing, amazing run.
First this evening, planning for a meeting between the Russian and Ukrainian presidents is underway, according to Donald Trump, who says he's spoken to Vladimir Putin by phone. The call came as Mr. Trump met with Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky and a number of key European leaders at the White House to discuss ending the war. A crucial outcome of the talks was an undertaking by Mr. Trump that the US would guarantee Ukraine's security in the event a deal is made with Russia. Kathleen O'Connor prepared this report.
Just 3 days after meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, President Donald Trump had his arm around Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky, guiding him inside the Oval Office to greet US officials, before sitting at a table with Europe's most powerful leaders for talks aimed at ending Russia's war in Ukraine.
Good to see you. Yeah, likewise. Thank you.
It's an honour to have the President of Ukraine with us.
Thank you for the invitation and thank you very much for your efforts, personal efforts to stop killings and stop this war.
Among the European leaders present were UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer and French President Emmanuel Macron, as well as the leaders of Italy, Germany, Finland and the European Union. The NATO Secretary General was also there. Keir Starmer says progress was made.
Today's meeting was good and constructive, and there was a real sense of unity between the European leaders that were there and President Trump and President Zelensky.
The meeting focused on security guarantees. US President Donald Trump told President Zelensky he'll provide protection for Ukraine against any further Russian attack if an agreement is reached with Vladimir Putin. But exactly what sort of security protections the US would provide is not clear. US Secretary of State Marco Rubio spoke afterwards on Fox News.
Ukraine post-conflict has a right to enter into security agreements with other countries, and we will work with our European allies and non-European countries, by the way, to build such a security guarantee. We're working on that right now.
Marco Rubio claims he was also in the room when US President made a phone call to the Russian President during the meeting.
The President suggested that Zelensky and Putin meet, so we're working on that now to try to set that up for them. And then if that goes well, hopefully the next meeting will be a meeting between Presidents Putin, Trump, and Zelensky.
Russian presidential speech representative Kirill Dmitriev posted on social media writing,
"An important day of diplomacy today with a focus on lasting peace and not a temporary ceasefire."
However, European leaders are sceptical about whether Russian President Vladimir Putin is truly interested in a peace deal. Alexander Stubb is the president of Finland.
You know, we are dealing with President Putin and we do have to understand that his, you know, basic strategic aims have not changed, and they are threefold. He wants to see Russia as a superpower. He wants to split the West, and he wants to deny the sovereignty of Ukraine. So that's the reality that we're dealing with.
But despite that skepticism, Volodymyr Zelensky says the meeting with Donald Trump was a big step forward.
We spoke about security guarantees. This is a key topic as a start of ending the war.
The US president saying he's no longer interested in a ceasefire agreement, instead seeking a lasting peace deal.
I know that it might be good to have, but I can also understand
strategically why, well, you know, one country or the other wouldn't want it. You know, I like the concept of a ceasefire for one reason, because you'd stop killing people immediately, as opposed to in 2 weeks or 1 week or whatever it takes. But we can work a deal where we're working on a peace deal while they're fighting. They have to fight.
Dr. Sonia Midsack is a research fellow in Ukrainian studies at the Australian National University.
President Zelensky gave a little bit more detail about how this security guarantee might look. Firstly, he said that it will take time to sort out the detail of the security arrangement, because there will be many countries involved and many countries will have different abilities. So some will be able to assist with finances, some will assist with military assistance. It'll take time to sort that out.
The security guarantee is just the first step. Dr. Sonia Midsack says there'll be no easy solution to the conflict.
Under what we call Russia's maximalist demands, Putin is actually demanding to take control of the whole of the Donbas region. That's two regions, Luhansk and Donetsk, and areas in the Donetsk region which are not occupied by Russia. Now, they are areas that contain Ukraine's military fortifications. So if Ukraine gives up those areas, Ukraine will be completely exposed without any defence. And of course, that would make it very, very easy for Russia to further attack and to reach Kyiv.
Dr. Sonia Midsack from the Australian National University. Kathleen O'Connor with that report. The report of South Australia's Royal Commission into Domestic, Family and Sexual Violence has made more than 130 recommendations to improve the systems in place to prevent and respond to abuse. The Royal Commissioner, Natasha Stott-Despoyer, found that victims often struggle to find help and are let down by a complicated and underfunded system. She's urging the state government to accept all of the Commission's recommendations. Angus Randall reports.
Domestic violence survivor Rabia Aftab was living in constant fear.
It escalated pretty quickly from physical to sexual, financial violence. He had very long knives, and he showed me one day and told me that these knives can easily slice a lamb.
She says she felt ashamed, and when she built up the courage to call a domestic violence crisis line, no one answered.
How many times when I made the call and no one answered, and I thought maybe I shouldn't make the call, maybe I should live just with this person and just wait when he's gonna kill me. I felt it would have been easier dying with him than fighting with this big system.
Eventually, Rabia Aftab escaped her situation and helped more than 100 people make their submissions to South Australia's Royal Commission into Domestic, Family and Sexual Violence over the past year.
They can feel that they don't have to live in an abusive relationship or environment. They deserve to live. They deserve to be safe.
More than 5,000 people shared their experiences with the inquiry, which was launched after four women were killed in South Australia in the space of a week 2 years ago. The report makes 136 recommendations, including a new standalone ministerial portfolio for domestic, family and sexual violence. It also calls for increased funding for support services and what it calls a single entry point for victim survivors when they first ask for help.
And this Royal Commission report gives us a roadmap for thoughtful policy interventions that will make a difference.
South Australian Premier Peter Malinauskas says his government has immediately accepted seven of the recommendations and the rest are under consideration.
We will be in a position to respond to the remaining 129 recommendations formally and comprehensively by year's end.
Commissioner Natasha Stott-Despoyer, who's also a former federal senator, says South Australia was once a leader in this area but has fallen well behind.
The Commission has found that the domestic, family and sexual violence system in this state is fragmented, it's crisis-driven and it's siloed. And without government stewardship or an accountability mechanism, no one is held responsible for when services fail people.
She says one of the biggest challenges is that those who ask for help often find it too difficult to navigate the system or are told they're not eligible for support.
The criteria is unnecessarily restrictive, and that's partly because those workers in the sector working tirelessly, but they're working with minimal resources. So that's why we're crisis driven. In some circumstances, most circumstances, if you're not a woman and you're not at risk of imminent harm or homelessness, then a lot of the time you won't get any support.
That's backed up by Professor Kate Fitzgibbon from Monash University, who spoke with more than 50 young victim survivors as part of her submission to the Royal Commission.
I repetitively heard young people who had sought help earlier in their experience of violence, but it wasn't until it reached crisis point that they were able to secure a response. We need to ensure that when a victim survivor wants to get help, they can, and that it's available for them in the most straightforward way possible, and that we're not requiring someone who is highly traumatised to navigate a spider's web of different organisations and entry points.
She says previous attempts at reform across the country show the South Australian government can't pick and choose which recommendations it approves.
It's critical that when the state government implements these recommendations, that they are done as a package. That is when they will be at their best. So we need to ensure now that there is an accountability on government, not to partially recommend, not to cut any corners, and to ensure critically that it is fully funded work.
Amanda Brownlee also made a submission to the Royal Commission. She was sexually assaulted during a night out at the Adelaide Fringe and reported it to police immediately. She says the police were helpful, but the legal process left her further traumatised.
It was incredibly challenging. I was told that I was credible and not reliable because I was drunk. I was told that I didn't push the perpetrator off me when I woke up, therefore he may have considered that to be consent.
Speaking before the report was handed down, Amanda Brownlee says today should mark the beginning of a complete overhaul of the system.
I feel really hopeful that this is a real opportunity for change, for generational change. This sort of work will really make a difference to a lot of people.
Sexual assault survivor Amanda Brownlee. That report from Angus Randall and Stephanie Richards. And if you're in an abusive situation or you know someone who is, please call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, call 000. The federal government's three-day economic reform roundtable is underway in Canberra as business and union leaders, politicians and experts thrash out their ideas to improve productivity. Tax reform is sure to be one of the top issues for debate, including proposals to cut the company tax rate. Luke Radford has more.
Mark Verscher is no stranger to the challenges of doing business as a manufacturer in Australia.
Look, it is tough. It's not easy. Taxation, of course, is a primary concern, but you've got to be able to get to a point where you're profitable. And there are a lot of obstacles associated with running a business, be it regulatory, compliance.
He's the managing director of Fairmont Medical, which manufactures medical products in Melbourne. It makes things like oxygen masks and surgical equipment. And despite building up his business over three decades, he's not encouraging others to do the same.
I started my business at 25, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and today my enthusiasm for business, and I really would not encourage startups. It's just too hard under the current environment of what we have to go through in order to be successful.
The challenges faced by businesses in the advanced manufacturing and other innovative industries are front of mind at the Economic Roundtable in Canberra this week. One of the proposals being debated there is whether to cut the amount of tax paid by companies. The Productivity Commission is leading the charge, proposing a 20% tax rate on profits for companies with revenue of up to $1 billion. The current rate is 30%. Cheryl Murphy is the regional chief economist for EY, and it's a concept she supports.
One example might be a big cut to the corporate tax rate for a particular industry. So if we say that's advanced manufacturing, then we think that that would be enough to really kind of bring some of the most productive commerce in the world to Australia, and importantly, stop some of our advanced manufacturers leaving the country because they simply get better tax breaks and a better deal elsewhere.
So in your mind, is that the one thing that's keeping advanced manufacturing away from Australia, to follow your example?
as I say, it wouldn't necessarily be advanced manufacturing. It could be in other areas like energy or medical science or telco. But it's certainly what we are seeing, and we're seeing this with our clients, is that they are often, even though they're Australian-based companies, they're taking their R&D type activity and their investment activity offshore and doing it there where they get a better deal.
Cheryl Murphy says EY's modelling shows that dropping the corporate tax rate to 15% for advanced manufacturing would deliver an additional $1 billion a year. EY is not the only group modelling what a corporate tax cut would look like. The Centre of Policy Studies at Victoria University did similar modelling on behalf of the Productivity Commission. Associate Professor Jason Nassios is the centre's Deputy Director.
We found that this windfall gain, or this upfront transfer to existing foreign capital that's invested and deployed here in Australia already at the 30% rate, just giving them this free kick can never be claimed back. So they'll invest a bit more, we'll get more foreign capital in the long run, we'll be able to tax that at the lower corporate income tax rate, but it's never enough to recoup our upfront windfall loss.
He argues that while the tax cut looks good on paper initially, most of the benefit would end up flowing offshore and not actually benefit Australians. So what else could the government do to get business in Australia moving? Jason Nassios says the answer is still tax cuts, but at the state level instead.
What we've looked at is Australia's tax system as a whole. So not just looking at the federal system, where really you've got, say, three taxes, four taxes, maybe if you include fuel excises, you've got personal income tax, corporate income tax, GST and fuel. We've looked at all the state taxes and how they look. So in terms of the best bang for your buck reform at the moment, and something that really hasn't been spoken much about in the lead up to this productivity roundtable, is state tax reform.
And that kind of change is exactly what medical manufacturer Mark Verscher is after.
We're paying close to $250,000 per annum towards payroll taxes. We've experienced over the last 5 to 6 years a doubling, if not tripling, of the costs associated with land tax, which is obviously incorporated in our rent and lease costs. So these are the costs that impede our ability to reinvest in our organisation and obviously create jobs and opportunities for Australians through the efforts of our business.
Mark Verscher, the Managing Director and owner of Fairmont Medical. That report from Luke Radford. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Just a reminder, you can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. The best-selling Irish author Sally Rooney is facing possible charges under the United Kingdom's Terrorism Act. Known for novels including Normal People and Conversations with Friends, Ms. Rooney has recently promised her royalties will go to the group Palestine Action. It was declared a terrorism organisation by the UK government last month. Sally Rooney's decision coincides with an author boycott of a Victorian Writers' Festival, which was accused of restricting free speech on the Gaza conflict. Kimberly Price reports.
Her stories have captivated audiences around the world, though Irish author Sally Rooney has largely stayed out of the public's eye. Some of her wildly successful novels have been adapted for television by the BBC, including Conversations with Friends and Normal People.
I'll go.
But this week, Sally Rooney has published an opinion piece in the Irish Times newspaper, promising to use earnings from her books to support a group called Palestine Action. While that may not sound controversial, Palestine Action has been recently classified as a terrorist organisation under the United Kingdom's Terrorism Act, meaning the author could face criminal charges. It's a pro-Palestinian protest group in the UK. In particular, it's targeted military manufacturers. It was proscribed a terrorist group after its members broke into a Royal Air Force base and spray-painted two planes.
Academics, human rights organisations and others have long sounded warning bells about the breadth of terrorism laws in the UK. The response has always been that, well, sure, the laws might be quite broad, but we rely on our good sense of knowing what is appropriate to prosecute or not in terms of discretion.
That's Kieran Hardy, an associate professor at Griffith University's Criminology Institute. He says Australia's own terrorism laws were modelled on the UK Act.
So basically all countries to start legislating against terrorism in response to the September 11 attacks, we were all scrambling to come up with new terrorism laws, but the UK already had this Terrorism Act 2000 in place before then. So Australia, Canada, other countries, you know, basically copied the UK legislation to a large degree.
However, there are some key differences in Australia's terrorism laws.
The list of terrorist organisations that we have in Australia does not, as of now, include a group like Palestine Action. In Australia's definition of terrorism, we did include, so we largely copied the UK, but we did include an exemption for political protest.
The conflict in the Middle East has caused tensions within the art scene. Over the weekend, a string of authors pulled out of the Bendigo Writers' Festival in Victoria because of a code of conduct the event had established for panellists to abide by. Many felt it would limit their ability to speak freely about the Israel-Gaza conflict. Dr. Dennis Muller is a senior research fellow at the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne. He says when authors publish their political views, it can have both positive and negative outcomes.
I think for most writers, they would be prepared to put their views ahead of their sales. Most writers are people of pretty strong principles, pretty strong views, and I think that's what we look for in writers.
Dr. Muller believes Sally Rooney's decision to support Palestine Action will increase the focus on freedom of speech issues globally.
The stand taken by people like Rooney draws attention to that fact. It may in the end finish up with the laws in Britain being reviewed and perhaps being made less oppressive.
The British government did not respond to Sally Rooney's case, but did confirm supporting Palestine Action was an offence.
Kimberly Price reporting. Well, when he had life-saving heart surgery 4 decades ago, I bet New South Wales man Ray Hildridge didn't expect to set a world record. But that's what he's done, having become the longest surviving quadruple bypass patient in the world. Emma Simpkin has the story.
Back in 1982, at the relatively young age of 34, Ray Hildridge found himself needing the services of a cardiologist.
High cholesterol, and I had blocked 4 arteries. The arteries needed to be replaced, and bypass surgery, grafts, were new to Australia at that time. Only St Vincent's Hospital were doing it.
That's how he came to be under the care of the renowned heart surgeon Dr. Victor Chang, and the quadruple bypass he performed has kept Mr. Hildridge alive.
In those days, you stayed in hospital for 2 weeks after. I was got out, and that's the day after I got out of hospital.
And whose wedding's that?
A niece. And that's the difference between me and probably other patients. I was young. I was reasonably fit, used to referee soccer.
Dr. Victor Chang was murdered 9 years later in 1991 in a crime that shocked the nation. But his legacy lives on for people like Ray.
Victor Chang was an outstanding surgeon, and he was a talent. And I mean, I think we still see patients of his from way back in those days. So it's a testament to the man.
That's Dr. Brendan Gunnellingham, Ray's current cardiologist. He says Ray is the youngest patient he's seen receive a quadruple bypass at St Vincent's Hospital.
For someone that has had progressive, aggressive coronary disease like he has had, it's a remarkable achievement. Had his original bypass some 42 years ago, and then has had 2 further bypass operations since then. And I've been looking after him for the last 14 years, I think, and we've done sort of angiograms and stents, and he's still going strong.
And last month, Ray Hildridge passed an impressive milestone, becoming the longest surviving recipient of a quadruple bypass. He surpassed the previous record of 42 years and 284 days. Ray's wife of 57 years, Marilyn, did all she could to help, hiding his cigarettes back in the 80s and making sure he followed doctor's orders.
I used to pack Ray's salad after his first bypass, and I often wondered what happened to that salad.
I think it might have went in the garbage. Well, I wasn't a salad person earlier. Now I am.
And Professor Jason Kovacic, CEO of the Victor Chang Cardiac Research Institute, thinks it's a record that could be hard to beat.
These days, often try to, you know, someone might get a stent or might start with very powerful medical therapies rather than going to bypass surgery at such a young age. Absolutely, the approach to this has evolved significantly, but he's to be roundly congratulated on, you know, an amazing, amazing run.
Congratulations to Ray indeed. That's the director of the Victor Chang Cardiac Research Institute, Jason Kovacic. That report from Emma Simpkin. Thanks for joining me for PM. Good night.
If the Putin-Trump meeting on the weekend brought about anything, it was a closer relationship between the two leaders. One, an accused war criminal, the other, a convicted felon. So, what will Vladimir Putin do next? Today, Russia expert Matthew Sussex from the Centre for European Studies at the ANU on Putin's ultimate aim. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on the ABC Listen app.